The 2022 Oregon Legislative Session convened on February 1st. The Oregon Justice Resource Center will reintroduce three bills that were unsuccessful in the 2021 legislative session. With me is Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Zach, talk about the three bills you'll be reintroducing in Salem.
So we have three bills, as you mentioned. The first is the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act, which is Senate Bill 1584. Last session, it was SB 499, so Senate Bill 499. And just a quick overview is it provides exonerees access to the court to address harm caused by the state and to be compensated for that harm for their years wrongfully incarcerated and on supervision. The second bill is Restoration of Voting Rights Act. It's HB House Bill 4147. This was last session. It was on the House and the Senate side as HB 2366 and SB 571. And this is being introduced by Rep. Reynolds this session. And it would allow people who are currently incarcerated in Oregon prisons to vote while they are incarcerated. And then finally, the third one is Compassionate Medical Release, which is SB 1568. It's being introduced by Senator Dembro and Rep. Reynolds in the Senate this session. And it's formerly HB 3298. And SB 835 last session. And so that's being introduced to fix the compassionate release process and system that we currently have in place, which is the pandemic has highlighted some significant concerns with that process.
So let's start with the compassionate release bill, Senate Bill 1568. That is releasing adults in custody under extraordinary circumstances.
What I would say is that the pandemic has kind of highlighted a lot of areas that need to be improved in the criminal justice system. That's not to say that this was working before the pandemic, but it was definitely highlighted because no one was being released under it, right? So instead of the Board of Parole being able to release under their compassionate medical release process that currently exists, Governor Brown ended up having to grant a lot of clemencies using her clemency power. And so that was concerning to us because that's not necessarily the way it's supposed to work. There should be a robust system for the Board of Parole to weigh in on these situations and allow individuals who qualify for compassionate release to be released under it. So the information we've received is that only two people in about the past 8-9 years have actually been released under it. And it's because when individuals apply for it, they generally are superseded by those who are currently seeking parole or release from the Board of Parole. And so they are knocked down. And the Board of Parole is just overworked, and so they don't get to these cases and these applicants.
There has to be extraordinary, compelling reasons to release a person in custody. So talk about some of these reasons that this bill would require before someone is released from prison.
Absolutely. So this generally, what we're trying to get at are individuals who are, you know, medically infirm or vulnerable. And so I believe the one criteria is individuals who are terminally ill, and I believe we've set that at 12 months, and so they would be able to be released under this. And what we've done is we've set the bill up so that it's implemented kind of in phases. And so between hopefully the implementation in 23 after the 22 session and 2025, there's a very small amount of individuals who will be eligible for release, and there's a cap of 5 people per month that can be released under the bill. And that's to allow for ramping up of administrative positions and also to allow this independent committee that we've established under the bill to get up and running. And so individuals who have serious medical concerns would be able to be eligible under the bill. And then that criteria should expand once we get to the year 2025.
And talk about this medical release advisory committee that you just mentioned. Now, that is something that is new, that people are not being reviewed by medical personnel. Is that correct?
Currently, the Board of Parole, who I don't believe have any medical professionals amongst them, they would be taking in these applications and making this analysis. And a lot of times what we find is whether it's because of the current system, how it's set up, or whether it's because they're not medical professionals, the analysis generally starts with a public safety analysis and then shifts to the compassionate release or the medical issues. And we believe at OJRC that it should actually be the other way around. When you're talking about compassionate medical release, you should be talking about the medical conditions first and whether someone qualifies, and then the public safety second. And so that's the way this is set up, to allow an independent committee made up of 5 to 13 medical professionals, licensed medical professionals, who can review these applications and say whether someone meets the criteria They will then give a recommendation to either the board or the sentencing court. Those are the two routes that you can go for various kind of technical legal reasons. Certain people will be eligible through the sentencing courts, and certain people will be eligible through the Board of Parole to be released. So the independent committee will then make a recommendation, and that recommendation is a presumption. So there's presumption attached. And so what ends up happening is that the Board of Parole or the sentencing court will have to show by clear and convincing evidence that someone is a threat to public safety to kind of overcome that presumption of release from the independent committee.
So, Zach, the second bill is SB 1584, the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act. Talk about this act. And also talk about these bills and why you feel that they will be successful in this new 2022 session.
So this bill is an amazing bill. It feels common sense to us. But last session, I will say that there were some issues with the fiscal analysis and how much it was going to cost the state. And I think that kind of got us caught up last session. And so this session, or in the interim between last session and this session, we've worked very closely with kind of a coalition. We call it the Oregon Innocence Coalition, which is the Oregon Innocence Project, which is under the Oregon Justice Resource Center, the National Innocence Project, and then also Forensic Justice Project, which is another Portland-based nonprofit. And so we have worked together with the Department of Justice on the fiscal impact that this bill is going to have. And we've had numerous meetings with them and, you know, happy to report that we've figured out the fiscal and we are working with the Ways and Means Committee, which is the budgeting committee. And also the Department of Justice has now come out in publicly in support of the bill and believes that this should be accomplished this session. So we feel really, really good about the bill moving forward. The bill is going to be introduced by Senator Thatcher again, who's a Republican senator in Oregon. And she's going to be reintroducing the bill this session. That said, the bill has significant bipartisan support. And mainly, I think that's to do with just the Oregon value of compensating individuals who were exonerated and spent years upon years in prison for something that they didn't do. And so this bill provides exonerees access to the court to address harms caused by the state, being the wrongful conviction. It would provide $65,000 per year of wrongful imprisonment. It would provide $25,000 for every year spent on parole, post-prison supervision, or sex offender registry. On top of the monetary compensation, it would also provide access to non-monetary services, which would include counseling, housing assistance, personal financial literacy assistance, those kind of non-monetary support systems that need to be included in this bill. And then it would ensure a straightforward process for filing compensation claims through the court. So currently, individuals would have to file a lawsuit, a civil rights lawsuit generally, in the courts. And so it's a long drawn out process. And the hope is that this will streamline that process for exonerees. And then lastly, addressing kind of the concerns for reentering society back, even as an exoneree, the bill would expunge the records associated with the wrongful conviction and arrest and provide a certificate of innocence. That way the exonerees hopefully can stand a better chance of clearing the record and bringing their name back to being able to get jobs and moving forward in their life.
So let's go to the third bill, voter registration, and that is House Bill 4147, and again, did not pass the 2021 legislative session. So talk about this bill.
This is a bill that would actually be the first in the nation. It would re-enfranchise about 12 to 13,000 individuals who are currently in prison who are not allowed to vote. And so it's being introduced by Rep. Reynolds this session. I would say that last session, what happened similar to compensation is the bill passed out of Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the policy committee, and then was languished, I would say, in the budgeting committee, the Ways and Means Committee. And that was from a Department of Corrections fiscal that was kind of unanticipated. And I think there were some concerns amongst legislators with kind of what the bill actually does. And so our goal was to clarify what it does and to address the fiscal issue in the interim. And so we've been working really hard to kind of educate the legislature on what the bill does and what it doesn't do, and then also addressing the fiscal with Department of Corrections. And so the bill, mainly what it does is, as I mentioned, it provides incarcerated individuals access to the political system by restoring their right to vote. And so we're working with Next Up Oregon on this bill, and we really see it as a pro-democracy bill. I think it impacts criminal justice, but it really is about re-enfranchising individuals and allowing them to have a say and a voice.
So can you talk a little bit about the history of why prisoners or adults in custody are not allowed to vote here in Oregon?
The landscape is that there's only been two states that didn't disenfranchise currently incarcerated individuals, Maine and Vermont, which those of us who are familiar with the East Coast would know that those are two of the whitest states in the country. And so that's telling because the history behind disenfranchisement generally, including those who are currently incarcerated, and this applies to even people convicted of felonies being disenfranchised, which in Oregon is no longer the case. But in other states, it is still the case. And it's born out of the Jim Crow era. It is based on Black exclusion laws and the understanding that if the system disproportionately incarcerates people of color, and then you disenfranchise those same people who are being incarcerated, you are therefore being able to suppress the voices, essentially, of the communities of color. And so that's really what this is born out of. And I think what ends up happening is people conflate this with just the way it's supposed to be or the way it's always been. And that's not necessarily the case. So for example, in Oregon, we don't need a constitutional amendment because Oregon's constitution prohibits people in prison from voting unless otherwise provided by law. And so here it's just a statutory change which requires a simple majority vote. In contrast to Illinois, which is running a similar bill in February as well in their session over there, you know, there's an argument there about whether there needs to be a constitutional amendment. The proponents are saying there doesn't, but that's not the case in Oregon. It really is a statutory fix because it's not always been the case in Oregon that individuals who are incarcerated can't vote.
So how important is it to hear the voices of adults in custody through their vote?
The importance of voting, really, the best people to speak to that are people who are currently incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. I myself am formerly incarcerated, and so I have a unique kind of insight into why it's important. I think that there's a misunderstanding out there that people who are incarcerated aren't civically engaged or don't want to be engaged in the community. And that's just not the case. Those who are incarcerated still have family on the outside in the communities. So it's really important, especially with school board elections, the way we've seen them in Oregon and across the country. Individuals who are incarcerated with kids want to have a say in who's leading the school districts for which their kids are attending. And they want to have a say in how the community that they're spouse or family is living in. And so that's why this bill, which allows them to register at their last voluntary address, is really important because they're not voting where the prison is located. They're voting in the communities that they're from and that they're going to be returning to, since 95% of individuals who are in prison are going to be returning to the community. And then those who are currently incarcerated, who even if they're not going to get released, there are unique situations that people who are incarcerated face. For example, I believe the Oregonian found that it's something like individuals who are incarcerated are 10 times more likely to contract COVID than those in the general population. And there's also the wildfires was another example of situations that impact mainly just those who are incarcerated. So the wildfires impacted a lot of Oregonians, but the ones who are incarcerated can't just evacuate. They can't just move. They're at the mercy of DOC. And so those issues aren't necessarily understood by the legislators as much or as well, because those who are incarcerated aren't constituents. And so there's less of incentive to listen to them. So that's why it's really important that they be allowed to vote. There's issues that impact them just like everyone else in Oregon. But I would encourage anyone who can to listen to the hearing that we had on HB 2366 last session in rules. And we had two individuals, we were able to record their testimony, two currently incarcerated individuals who spoke. And I think when you compare that to individuals in the general public who maybe don't see voting as being important, or, you know, maybe don't trust the voting process or the elections process and don't value it, when you contrast that with the adults in custody who spoke at that hearing, it's really pretty evident how important this is to those who are incarcerated to be able to vote.
One of my favorite quotes from one of those adults in custody was, "Prison is about the loss of liberty, not the loss of citizenship."
Absolutely. And that's a perfect example. You know, one of the arguments we hear a lot of times against the bill is that these individuals committed a crime and therefore they should lose their rights. Well, that's a pretty bold statement. I think that anyone who has been incarcerated understands the real significant punishment is the loss of liberty. You can't go where you want, when you want. You're residing in a place that you don't have any choice or say in. And so that's really the punishment. And there's no nexus between the punishment of losing the right to vote and any of the crimes that these individuals are serving time on. And so I think that's hugely important to remember. We shouldn't just strip away rights just because it's something that we've done for years or because we want to punish individuals. That's the loss of liberty.
For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.